Welcome to a new episode of Becoming a Post-Growth Planner, Obstacles and Challenges to Changing Roles and Practices. My name is Christian Lamker, Assistant Professor at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. And today, my special honor is to welcome Anna Pagani from King's College London, special because at the end of 2025, she was involved in the manifesto of Housing for a Post-Growth World. We will get there during the coming 25 minutes or so. Anna has also longstanding experience in systems approaches and housing across Europe.
Hi everyone. Yes, so my name is Anna and I'm a senior lecturer at King's College London in the Department of Engineering. And I'm also an honorary associate professor at University College London. And my research focuses specifically on systems thinking, housing justice and degrowth. And I teach engineers, but also planners, economists, and architects to think in systems, to value and understand the meaning of participation, and to try as best as they can to integrate different worldviews.
Cool. Yeah, housing is a reoccurring concern in post-growth literature and activism, and it has also run out through multiple of the previous podcast talks, for example, with Anitra Nelson, with Ophia Greaves, and also many others before. Why is housing so crucial for yourself also with relation to post-growth?
So more generally, I want to start by saying why housing indeed is crucial for within my pathway. So when my parents married, they had a guest signing their wedding book. And they had the most beautiful writings and sentences. But one of their friends, instead of sending a writing message, left a small drawing, which was a little house with a sun inside. And that picture really stayed with me because housing is really a basic need. It reflects the culture of a society. It shapes the way we inhabit the world. But it also has some permeable boundaries that I'm always fascinated about. Is housing exactly just those four walls, or does it take into account also the entrance? Does it take into account the corridor that leads to that? And what about the cafe in the front or where I go running in the morning? And from a research perspective, housing is really the territory of a number of disciplines. So I'm an architect as a background, but we can include and study its envelope, the lifestyles of who inhabits it, the policies that shape access to it. So it's really a fascinating inter- and transdisciplinary space.
Yeah, I clearly hear your fascination. And you have done quite some versatile research on housing, especially also social housing, residential preferences, post-growth in a Swiss and in the United Kingdom perspective. You are now in London. What are the major characteristics of these different housing markets?
So I think that there is two important data points that would really help us understand how different these two housing markets are. So I always say that Switzerland has 60% of households who live in a rented or a cooperative dwelling. And the UK has around 35% of people living in some form of renting, being social housing or other. So quite a big difference. One in every five citizens in a city like Zurich lives in a cooperative, which is impressive, right? In London, it's something like 0.1%. So also a big gap. Switzerland has rent protection. My rent has never increased when I was living in Switzerland. And when I moved to the UK, our landlord increased the rent by more than £1,000 after a couple of months that I was in there. So in the UK, housing is regularly on the first page of all newspapers. There is a strong rhetoric of building new, building more, the build, baby, build, which is strongly entrenched in all UK discourses. Also because it is a key driving factor of economic growth. And this is because housing has been strongly financialized, especially since Margaret Thatcher. We might touch upon this later on. So for me, moving to the UK as a housing scholar was a little bit like for a structural engineer to move to Japan, you know, for an earthquake engineer. So that was a bit my experience.
Yeah, but I'm very happy talking to you because you try to think housing differently in the UK and beyond the UK. And in one of your recent publications, you asked the question, what if there were a moratorium on new house building, an exploratory study with London-based housing associations? It was published in the Built Environment in 2025. So if I now ask you, what's the answer to that question? What would actually happen?
So in order to answer that question, we need to take a little bit, a small step back. So what did we do? How did we answer that question? So we asked ourselves as researchers that question to four of the largest housing associations in the UK. So what they did, they had systems maps in front of them. And those systems maps were developed collaboratively, and they were showing the causes and consequences of the decline of the social housing sector in the UK. For instance, maintenance and repair, demolition, lack of infrastructure, both physical and social, lack of community engagement in decision making. So these maps were showing those complex relations, and they had been built with them over a couple of months. And by looking at those maps, they were asked this question: what would happen if we were to stop building? And housing associations raised a couple of challenges, but during the discussion, all of these challenges were followed up by ideas and feedback on how transformative this process was of discussing and using systems maps. So we isolated the challenges that housing associations raised, and we went back to our desk and checked data. And I can share what are the six main takeaways. So firstly, what we found is that a moratorium will help us challenge the narrative around the housing crisis. Of course, there is a housing crisis, but supply has outpaced demand across England since 1996. And the construction of housing has a very marginal effect on housing prices, because often housing targets are nearly set arbitrarily to more feed the economy that actually benefit everyone. So the goal of this system is growth for the sake of growth. And so what we need to do is to reframe the narrative, shifting it from building to afford. So I continue building so that I can afford housing, to actually maintain, to inhabit. So that's the first point. The second point is that a moratorium would push us to engage with the notion of sufficiency. So I often ask my students, do you have an idea of how many empty homes there are in England alone? Like hundreds of thousands. Sometimes some people raise their hands there. Well, estimate says that we have between 1 and 1.5 million empty homes, so that are vacant or second homes. Plus, if you think about those that are not empty, etc., we can also think that there is a very large amount of households who have two or more extra bedrooms, so spare bedrooms. So in general, this idea of scarcity of housing is artificial. And with my colleagues, we calculated that responding to the current government goal of building 1.5 million new homes, which has been promised by the Labour government, will be the equivalent of flying the entire UK population to New York, without counting the impact of biodiversity loss, etc. So the second point, sufficiency. The third point is that a moratorium would finally push us to innovate in design, planning, and management. And we really need that. And there are so many interesting ideas out there: community right to buy, empty homes programs, intergenerational housing. But it would also, as next point, challenge a bit the idea that we have that building new means building better, which is very entrenched in the idea of housing associations. Because actually a lot of research and practice is showing that retention and upgrade of the housing stock leads to better outcomes, environmental, social, and economic outcomes. But another question that is often raised is that, okay, fine, fair enough, but are they well located? I mean, where are those homes? And I can say that data shows that we have ghost enclaves, so places that have more than 20% of empty homes in the borough called City of London, in the main centre of London, as well as in other places like Camden or Kensington and Chelsea, etc., but also in a city like Cambridge. So they are all around us. And as last two points, so a moratorium would also help us redesign the business model of housing provision, because right now, housing, social housing in particular in the UK, that is really housing that should be for all, and for especially the people who are the largest housing needs, is financed through a mechanism that goes through the sale of market homes. It's called the cross-subsidy mechanism. And so here we could think about alternative forms that are already there: housing co-ops, community land trust, and many other strategies that will help us to retain instead of capturing the social and use value of land. And lastly, last point, Well, we would, a moratorium would force us to think in systems. We cannot have a moratorium without thinking in degrowth terms and thinking systems. This means thinking about our mental models, our assumptions, and challenge the system within which those assumptions are embedded. Because otherwise we risk a number of unintended consequences. For instance, in the social housing tenants, a bedroom tax was applied for which they were taxed if they were under occupied housing. But these people are those that are the least concerned about under occupation, under occupancy, or permitted development rights where offices are turned into homes. When this was applied through a growth driven perspective, what happened eventually is that they had to insert in new regulations the idea that a flat necessarily has to have a window, because otherwise it wouldn't be a flat. So just to give you an idea of what would happen if we were to stop building outside of a degrowth context.
System thinking, thinking in systems is something that strongly connects also our academic and thinking history over the last 10, 15 years and more. Now moving a bit more to leverage points for change. So recently, March 2026, you went even deeper into the question how system thinking may help us intervening in light of degrowth-oriented values. You published an analysis. The title is Identifying Leverage Points in the Social Housing System, Housing Associations on the Path Towards Degrowth in Ecological Economics. And there, I quote, you explored the perception of social housing providers about possible ways to address systemic issues in the social housing sector, end of quote. What are the major mental barriers that you discovered there?
I would say in general that from this study, we learned a couple of things. So first, to answer your question, I will reach the answer to your question. So first, when we use systems thinking, housing associations are really able to think of interventions in the system that are aligned with degrowth. So this was a fascinating outcome. So they were just using these systems maps and they were thinking about how do we intervene? And then when we checked, are there interventions aligned with degrowth? Well, actually they were. And this was fascinating. So this encouraged me to think that really when we have a genuinely participatory systems thinking approach, then we can really help participants address systemic issues and formulate systemic responses, even when we don't expect it, even with the people that we least expect. So I want to emphasize also that none of the participants had ever heard about degrowth, and I did not mention this term at any point. And this is another lesson learned, so the systems approaches can really help us find meaningful ways to talk about degrowth. But we did not only ask participants to think in terms of interventions, we also asked them to organize those interventions according to how feasible and how impactful they were according to them. And if a measure was strongly impactful but little feasible, we were asking them, well, what is an obstacle? And that's where I come to your point. So of course, these revealed obstacles, and those obstacles often have to do with their perception of power and agency on whether they can do it. So whenever there was actually, yeah, this is highly impactful, but not very feasible. Why is it not feasible? Well, you know, it does not depend on us. It's government. It's this, it's that, et cetera, et cetera. And a participant really said that the intervention would require changing the mindset of everyone who is involved in housing so that everyone would have to go through this process that we were doing. But actually, those perceptions of agency and power, it's the next paper that my colleague, Dr. Olivia Fritz, and I are in the process of publishing. So perceptions of power in the social housing sector.
Perception of power, does money also play a role? Or?
Yeah, if we think about it, power is also linked to do I have the possibility to access certain funding? And for instance, if it is government that decides where is budget allocated, it is also a form of power and disempowerment. It is a structural power. So there is discursive power, instrumental power, and structural power. So in instrumentals, and it's really like, am I able to act right away? And these causes are the discourses that are around there. But then, you know, the structural or institutional power that is in there instead is really like the what creates the condition for certain actions to flourish. And that is what often is linked to government.
So when you get down to real actors and discuss options, then it seems that some interventions are thinkable that are even in line or partly in line, at least with degrowth values and degrowth futures. Individually, it works, to some degree, but stepping out to use the systems approach to look at housing systems as such, where are then the leverage points? Where is it, or where or when is it worth pushing also the smaller ones, the smaller parts of feedback loops, push forward some information, and when and how should we then nevertheless push more towards goals, mindsets, paradigms as such, this point where basically everyone should change a bit, undergo through your own process or some other process that leads to this kind of changing mindset?
Yeah, so I think that what comes out of our paper, and so what comes out of a lot of reflection and thinking, is that we really need what we call a kind of a coordinated combination of those interventions that touch different leverage points, both the shallow and the deep. We need both. We cannot only think about interventions that are shallow or only those that are deep. Shallow because maybe they're easier to develop, and deep because they are the most transformative. And this is very much aligned with the idea of Paolo and colleagues in the fact that degrowth is a strategic assemblage. And I really like this concept. And what we did, what we did is that we did a final workshop where we brought all the housing associations and many different actors, so also developers, architects, residents, activists together. And we asked them to organize those different interventions linked to different leverage points around one deep leverage point. So they had one deep leverage point in there, and they had to organize the interventions that have thought of to create kind of packages of solutions. And this helps us think in terms of unintended consequences and co-benefits. So I will not have the silver bullet in telling you, well, all these interventions shallow are needed and all these deep ones are needed, but that we do need those kind of conversation on how to strategically create packages that help maximize co-benefit between one intervention and another. So, and we also need to take into account a word of caution. So we need to consider two things. Firstly, is that really, how do we go about it? So once we have those interventions and those packages, how do we actually implement that? Well, we know that in the degrowth spectrum, there are some quite some tensions also in what is the way to go. And so that would be a different conversation. And secondly, also that it is not always so evident whether the proposed intervention is actually a deep one or a shallow one. Because, for instance, there were many interventions about participation, and participation can be implemented in very different ways, and it can end up being an empty exercise or reproduces issues of individual responsabilization in a neoliberal way. So it needs a lot of conversation. But I think that that exercise of creating those packages, of thinking about co-benefits, that's where really the change starts. And that's where we really start thinking about how to pave the way through shallow intervention to deeper ones.
Yeah, I promised before that we will also get to the manifesto Housing for a Post-Growth World that you were heavily involved in. It began with a group of engaged people, activists, practitioners, researchers at the International Degrowth Conference 2025 in Oslo. But then which are the concerns that first united your group to start that? And then maybe even more interesting, where did you also have the most intensive or even conflictual debates to get to this manifesto?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. And I think it wouldn't have popped up anywhere else. So it's good to be able to discuss this. So what united us? Well, a little bit like I was talking about the drawing of my parents with the house and the sun in there. To a certain extent, it's this idea that really we cannot think of any future if we don't think about housing. And we all agreed that what we have right now in terms of the system is just relentlessly really driven by growth imperatives, and that we have a number of consequences that all of us as researchers, activists, and the people who are in there are observing: unhealthy, unsafe, overcrowded, over underheated, inadequate housing more generally, and these seeing in parallel to the soaring greenhouse gas emissions, biodiversity loss, all what we're witnessing, we have that in common. And drafting the manifesto was a process in which we were trying to learn how to share, how to forge a shared language. And we wanted, the ambition was really to unite different struggles and visions for the future across geographies, across political perspectives. And of course, it's a challenge because differences, for instance, emerged, especially in the process of finding examples and of And actually, these differences are really at the heart of the degrowth word that I was mentioning in the question before. Because when we look for examples, some of us might be looking more for top-down, state-led solutions that we called more eco-socialist solutions, and they're very frequent in housing. We can think, especially when we look at the Viennese case study, who wouldn't think, okay, that's such an incredibly good example of housing. So it's an inspiration for many. But on the other hand, we also have bottom-up, stateless, community-led, and anarchist approaches that include squatting, cooperatives, community interest, and other solutions. And we needed to somehow find compromises, because we wanted to find a way for everyone to identify themselves in this manifesto at this stage.
Yeah, a manifesto is always somewhat a call to action, a call to read it, but then even more to use it in different practices afterwards. What are the key points of this call to action?
Exactly. It is a call to action. And what I particularly appreciate of the way in which we set it up is that we also want to show that this is possible and that this is already happening. And that's why in the manifesto, we don't only talk about the problems and what should be done, but we also give examples of people who are already doing that. So our four key points, it's four. So the first is that we need to generate an ideological shift. This means really reframing homes as shared resources. And those resources are grounded in care, in affordability, in connection to places, instead of the strong ideology of private asset in a property-owning democracy, which we have right now. The second is to liberate housing from market pressures and to really reclaim it. So actively reclaim it as a collective right and as ecological responsibility. And here we need to really start reconsidering the tight link between profit-driven development, demolition, intensive construction, etc. And that's what we clearly outlined in the manifesto. Our third point is to base all of these house building targets that we hear, especially in the UK, all the time, we need to base them on just, sufficient, and collectively agreed distribution of the housing stock. So here it's really our battle to stop having the environment paying the price for social inequalities and disrupt really this artificial dichotomy between environmental justice and housing justice, because those two seem to be fighting different battles, because housing justice campaigners really need housing and want social housing and welcome when social housing is built. And it seems completely incompatible in a growth-driven world, in a perspective with environmental goals. So we need to break that artificial dichotomy, because it is often used in support of green growth narratives. And as a last point, we try to encourage everyone to broaden the focus. It was also my very first point in this podcast. Housing is a decentralized infrastructure. It goes much beyond the individual unit or household. And there are so many alliances that could be built beyond the boundaries of the house. For instance, if we consider the impacts on health, jobs, education, community life, and the wider transformation that alternative housing models could offer in terms of food, labor, and the way in which we live together. These were our four points.
Yeah, the full manifesto is also available online, including more on the examples. If I look into that, the focus on equity, care, ecological responsibility is rooted in that manifesto. But from there on, if we move close to the heart of spatial planning and the role of spatial planners, what would you advise a spatial planner who is involved with housing questions today to think about, or even to do differently, maybe right away, starting today or tomorrow?
Yeah, so our call to action, right? So it is not only a call to action. I also want to say that it's a framework for solidarity and it's a commitment. So that it would be important to keep in mind for a planner tomorrow. So have this in their hand, this manifesto in their hand, means really embracing a framework for solidarity and a real commitment. So if a spatial planner was tomorrow or today or now adhering to this manifesto, they couldn't try to pursue the realization of only one point in isolation. It will be very dangerous. And they cannot do this alone. So this will be the first 2 points. So, so from my personal perspective, I would say as a key recommendation to think in systems. So to learn systems thinking, understand interconnections, unintended be aware of unintended consequences and of possible co-benefits. And as this planner is learning to dance with systems, to cultivate awareness of their own and others' mental models. Because Donella Meadows, a fantastic systems thinker, used to say that everything we think we know about the world is a model, that our models do have a strong congruence with the world, but that our models fall far short of representing the world fully. Quote. And that's so what I would recommend any planner starting with the manifesto, reading it and wanting to apply it now.
Thank you. Yeah, in some way, this podcast series is also an attempt to reframe, readjust, implement, find another way to define what planning as such is or also could be in that sense, using the term post-growth planning for that. That's now the move to the very end of this episode. We have talked so much about details about housing, about your experiences with the manifesto, experiences in the UK, very down to leverage points. It's very hard to distinguish it to one line, I guess, but maybe you can give us a try to finish the line post-growth planning is.
Yes. So according to me, post-growth planning is, as I mentioned before, firstly, a collective activity of mutual learning. And this mutual learning must be informed by a systems approach. And the systems approach consists of identifying critical systemic issues, the mental models that produce them, to delineate shared goals, and to design transformative strategies that act at different leverage points in the system.
Thanks a lot, Anna. Many regards to London.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.